The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Okay, so can democracies and billionaires coexist? A lot of people have been, when they hear the name of that talk, they're like, oh, that's kind of a funky question. And I guess it's because in some ways, the obvious answer to this question in some ways is, well, yeah, of course they can coexist. Like, we have billionaires in this country, and we do live in a formal democracy, and there's a lot of countries around the world you can say the same thing about. Of course, we're going to get a little deeper than that in terms of what democracy really means. But it's worth going into that a little bit. I mean, the conventional wisdom in our society is that economics and politics are completely separate things, you know? So even the idea that democracy and billionaires, that there would be a contradiction between that is not the way we're encouraged to think about this, you know? Economics, politics, completely separate. The strange thing, though, is that we're also told the exact opposite thing, which is that capitalism and democracy go hand in hand, that they're totally linked, right? Very different than economics and politics are separate. So that should be sort of a propaganda alert right there. Anytime there's something that's justified by two opposite reasons, it should kind of make you question, you know, whether those reasons make sense. It's sort of like during the Iraq War when it was like, we've got to stay in Iraq because we're losing the war. Then we've got to stay in Iraq because we're winning the war. Now we're losing, we still have to stay. Like, no matter what, it was always for the same argument, right? So you should kind of question that premise when that's the case. I think that there is a growing sense among people that there's something wrong with democracy in this country, right? That there's something, that billionaires might have something to do with it, right? People like the Koch brothers in New York City, where I'm from, Michael Bloomberg, I just almost called him Michael Billionaire, which I may as well. he's the richest person in New York City, and he's the most powerful political person. Like, and there's a sense that, like, those things go hand in hand, and certainly after the Supreme Court Citizens United ruling, right, which basically the infamous corporations are people, and their form of free speech is spending money to buy candidates, you know, like that. That's going to be an infamous ruling in American history, and that's fueled this sense that there's something corrupted about democracy in this country. But one of the main themes that I'm going to be talking about is that the problems that we have in our democracy go a lot deeper than just Citizens United, go a lot deeper than how much money gets spent. Like, this is not going to be a whole talk about campaign finance reform, right? That's we try to look a little deeper. Democracy, because part of the problem with, we want to fight against Citizens United, but the problem with a lot of progressives who spend so much time just focusing on campaign spending on Citizens United is that it can kind of create this impression that if we just had better laws barring campaign spending, that we would have this really well-functioning democracy where people really had a say. And there's a much deeper problem with any democracy under capitalism, right? And so there's one theme that I'm going to want you to come away from this talk with, is that inequality, economic inequality, is political inequality. You can't draw a line between the two. And massive economic inequality, like when there's billionaires, means massive political inequality. And it doesn't matter, not that we shouldn't fight for campaign finance, you know, not that those aren't a good thing, but really laws aren't going to stop that. So in other words, the threat that billionaires pose to democracy isn't even what they do, it's just the fact that they exist. If some people have billions of dollars, while most of us have almost nothing, they are going to run the country, they are going to run the world, right? And expecting that can be stopped through just putting, you know, laws in place to limit campaign spending is sort of like expecting that the NSA, for instance, can store, as we learned last night, a trillion bytes of data. I can't even remember, but that they won't use it because, you know, there's laws in place that say that, you know, power is used inherently when you have it. And so I do think that it's become pretty common currency that a sense that there's something broken about government in the United States, right? But I think we should be clear: there's nothing broken about the government for the rich, right? For the status quo. Our government's very effective at sending special operations forces to different parts of the world. Our government is quite efficient at deporting people, more efficient than it's ever been in its history, bailing out banks, starting new drilling in shale fields and deep sea places where it hasn't been before. Our government's quite active and not broken. It's just broken in the sense of all the things that people have voted for the last 6 years don't seem to end up happening, right? It's the democratic part of the government that seems to be broken. And this isn't just a feeling that exists in this country. I mean, what we're seeing around the world is an explosion of protests. Right now it's Brazil and Turkey and started 2 years ago with the Arab Spring, the Occupy movement, the Indignados in Spain. There's a pretty global feeling that there's something broken about the democratic systems, whether people live in dictatorships or democracies. And you know, right now in Brazil, the New York Times, this is how, I thought they really encapsulated the way that our ruling classes look at democracy. That when the protests in Brazil first broke out, there's an article in the New York Times that said, "This country was once viewed as a stellar example of an ascendant democratic power, but it's been upended by an uprising with one theme, an angry rejection of politics as usual." So you get an idea. It's like, according to this report, Brazil was a good democracy when people were just kind of docile and obediently going along with what they call politics as usual, right? You're going to keep raising fares on buses and trains so that people can't afford it? That's fine. Spending money on all these World Cup stadiums instead of healthcare for the poor, that's good democracy, right? Or good democracy is, again, in Brazil, when people originally elect a radical party, the Workers' Party, right? And then that party, over the course of a decade, really becomes the Billionaires' Party. And it's not an exaggeration. Just last year, under this Workers' Party government, the number of billionaires in Brazil went up by 25%, from 37 to 46. There's a quote from the first president, the first Workers' Party president of Brazil, Lula, last year, defending his record against, he was trying to defend the Workers' Party against more right-wing critics, and he said, "The elite never earned more money than during my government, nor the newspapers that were also almost bankrupt when I assumed office. The corporations and the banks have never earned as much. But the workers have gained as well. The worker can only win when the company is doing well." That's not the Workers' Party the people in Brazil elected more than a decade ago, but that's Brazil being a good democracy. That kind of tame. So basically, like, folks, the ruling classes and mainstream media, they use the word good democracy to basically mean obedient. Almost like they thought, like, good democracy, yeah, it's very good. Like, that's sort of, that's their convention, that's their meaning of good democracy, right? But that's what's being rejected around the world in these protests that we're seeing. It's incredible. There's a lot of horrible, scary shit happening in the world, and this conference is full of discussions about that. We're also, though, living in the beginning of a period where there's revolutions and rebellions happening around the world for something different, for some kind of democracy. When I was a kid, in 1989, there was this wave of revolutions for democracy against, you know, Stalinist countries in Eastern Europe. And now we're seeing a wave of rebellions against capitalist governments that are trying to push austerity. And this is a really exciting, profound thing. And in country after country, protests that originally got started against, you know, austerity attacks, raising fares in Brazil, Scott Walker in Wisconsin trying to push through anti-union legislation and budget cuts, governments in Greece and Spain pushing through European union austerity, all these protests very quickly became also protests for a different type of democracy, people electing their own assemblies, trying to experiment with how we can take power. And so, you know, in the West, when people look at the Arab Spring, people would say, oh, finally the Middle East is having its democracy moment. And that's true, but really around the world, we're all having a bit of a democracy moment right now, even in countries that are formal democracies. And I don't want to minimize the difference between living under a dictatorship and living under, you know, a democracy, no matter how limited it is, right? If you think things are bad in Greece, they're worse in Syria, right, where there's a dictatorship. It's like people have been fighting throughout the Middle East to get rid of dictatorships, and they're very right to do so. But it's also very clear that what people are saying around the world who live in democracies is that this is not enough. We do not have any real say over the direction that the world is going in. The thing that's less clear right now is what is it that we're all fighting for around the world? These moments that came up like Occupy, you know, in Europe, in the Middle East. This question of what would a deeper democracy look like is still something that I think is really up in the air. And so a little contribution that I want to make today is, this is a starting point, a real democracy would mean there wouldn't be billionaires, right? That's literally what I want to talk about today, and what that means. So I want to get into just now talking about what are billionaires, because it's hard to actually conceive of just what even a billion is, right? Can anybody tell me what a billion is? A thousand million, okay? Good. Or a million thousand, right? Is also what a billion is. Everybody who didn't come up to say that, your eyes all just got a little glazed right there, like, math? Like, what the fuck just happened? So we're not, that isn't really all that helpful, right? we tend to use the word billion because it's so beyond our ability to comprehend, almost like an exaggeration, like, oh, that guy's like a billionaire. Like, we could be saying, like, he's a drazillionaire. Like, it's just sort of, like, bigger than a million, right? But the thing is, the relationship between a billion and a million is so much more even than an exaggeration, okay? Like, if you see someone who's really tall, like 6'5", and you're like, that person was like 10 feet tall, right? A billion is way more than a million. Like, basically, that would, the ratio, a billion is 1,000 million. That would be like seeing someone who's like 6'5", being like, that guy was like 6,500 feet tall, right? You don't even say that because it's ludicrous. A billion is a ludicrous number. It's ludicrous for anybody to have $1 billion. The meat of your typical family in the United States is worth $50,000. Like, that's the total, that's the wealth that they have, right? You'll sometimes hear the average wealth is $100,000, but that's because the billionaires are pulling up the average. The median in the middle is actually about $50,000. That's 1/20,000th of $1 billion. Okay, I know I'm doing the math again. Don't worry, I'm gonna stop with that. But just to give a sense, so one thing, Oxfam, you know, global relief organization, they said that the world's poorest people could be lifted out of poverty 4 times over just with the money that the 100 richest people around the world made last year alone, okay? So that's kind of horrifying that they don't do that, right? That there's people, that, you know, there's millions of people that actually die of hunger every year. But even that, it's like, okay, you're at a socialism conference, you've heard things like, it's still hard to get your head around it. So we gotta make this a little bit more personal, okay? How many people in this room, I want you to raise your hand, could really use $10,000 right now. Really, really use $10,000 right now. And if anybody want to volunteer, does anybody want to say like why they could really use $10,000? Like, yeah.
College.
College, cool. Anybody else? Like, what if you just came into $10,000, what you would spend it on?
Debt.
Credit card debt. Expecting a lot. Credit card debt, student debt.
Car payment.
Okay. And here comes the trickier question. What would anybody here do to get $10,000? Keep it clean. if someone were going to give you $10,000, would you kind of like maybe humiliate yourself for a day? Would you run out in the street naked? How many people would humiliate themselves maybe in front of strangers if they knew they were going to get $10,000 at the end of it? Really? Come on, okay.
Of course.
Let me ask a trickier question. How many of you would maybe, what if someone said for $10,000, just don't go to this one protest today, right? I'm not even gonna tell you why, just this one protest. And you'll have $10,000 at the end of the day. Now, no one at a socialism conference is gonna raise their hand and be like, oh, help me, I got no principles, but you would think about it, because it's $10,000 to not go to one protest. Why am I going down this road? Because if a billionaire was to give one of you guys $10,000, right, do you know what that would mean to that billionaire? In relation to a typical American, remember, someone who's worth $50,000, right, $10,000 to a billionaire is 50 cents to most of us. That's how much $10,000 is, right? So imagine for a second, put it the other way around. Think about if there were people you knew who were so impoverished and desperate that by giving them 50 cents, you can make them humiliate themselves, you can make them do whatever they want. What a distortion of power in human relationships, that some people have so much more than others, that they have that for 50 cents they could get you to do almost whatever they wanted. Let's put it in more real, less hypothetical terms, right? If $10,000 is 50 cents to a billionaire, well, they could set someone up with a job for some activists hire them for $100,000 a year at their nonprofit, and that costs them $5, right? They could spend $1 million to basically buy a local election, and that costs them $50. That's what it means to be a billionaire, and that's just to have $1 billion, right? So basically, having $1 billion, being a billionaire, makes you kind of like a god in some ways. It gives you these powers that ordinary people don't have. And just like in Greek mythology almost, our society, we have a whole freaking constellation of these gods out there who use their powers in different ways. And I just want to go through a few of our billionaires and how they use some of their godlike powers, right? We can start with the Koch brothers, Charles and David Koch. People have heard of them, mm-hmm. Right? You can hiss, it's okay, they're the Koch brothers. Each of them are worth $31 billion each, okay? And they've used their godlike powers to take an insane libertarian ideology, the same ideology that their father had, who was in the John Birch Society, and was basically like a political outcast and non-entity. But because they're each worth $31 billion, they've created organizations like Americans for Prosperity, ALEC, the lobbying group, and they've created an entire political culture of paranoid, gun-toting, climate change-denying libertarians, and made this like a real, viable political force. That's a godlike power to do that, right? Then you've got other billionaires, other supermen, the philanthropists, right? People like Eli Broad, who's worth $6 billion, Bill Gates, who's worth $66 billion, the Walton family, who are worth a combined over $100 billion. And these are all the people who fund the education reform movement, right? Pushing high stakes testing, closing down public schools and opening charter schools. People have probably been, busting teachers' unions because that's the main force that can oppose what they're doing. And I think the godlike power that the way that these philanthropists use their godlike powers is that they're able to dangle money that means nothing to them, 50 cents, $5 for them, right, in front of needy schools for whom this is, their entire future, and get all of our kids' schools completely transformed without the slightest hint of evidence that this stuff works, right? And that's how they've used their power. So, one example is the Gates Foundation, right? Diane Ravitch has written about this. They were big on small schools are better than big schools. Close down big schools, reopen small schools in their place. It's a pretty disruptive thing for kids and teachers and parents to shut down a school and reopen another one, right? They had no evidence that it worked, but after years of closing down thousands of schools, reopening other ones, it turned out they were like, oops, turns out it didn't make much of a difference, right? It reminds me of what, I don't know if people here have seen there's an education activist movie, The Inconvenient Truth Behind Waiting for Superman, that New York City teachers made. And in that movie, Brian Jones, who's like speaking right now, he's a teacher, and he talked about how sometimes being a teacher, it could feel like there's like these policy decisions being made in places where people have never been in a classroom, and then they just drop like bombs on your class. People here ever see Futurama cartoon? A little bit. There's an episode where Bender, the robot, I can't remember. He ends up with a whole planet on his back, right? And he's trying to, every time he even tries to help them, it's like his hand comes out and he's like crushing whole towns or whatever. That's kind of what I feel like the Bill Gates Foundation is a little bit. It's like, oh, we want to help you small schools, and it's just like you're crushing the work people are doing. I mean, basically, if Bill Gates is taking a shower and he has an idea, somewhere 10 schools are just blowing up, right? That's what being a god is. And then the last billionaire I want to talk about is the guy that I write about a lot, Michael Bloomberg, who's worth $25 billion. He's the mayor of New York City. And I wish I could tell you that most people in New York hate Michael Bloomberg, but it's actually not true. It's not that people like him or certainly love him, but the dude's one of the most successful politicians in New York in a long time. He bought a third term, but he's run for three terms. And he's a fairly successful politician, even though he can't give a speech, he can't connect emotionally with anybody, he's a total sexist pig, and he's really openly like a dick. I mean, that's even one of the things that New Yorkers kind of semi-like about him, is that he's a dick. And it's not just because he has all this money and he's bought off the opposition, although that's very much true. But the scary thing is that Michael Bloomberg has used his godlike powers to give him the very things that we were always taught when we were kids that money isn't supposed to give you. It's given him a personality. It's given him integrity. It's given him a soul, right? Because Michael Bloomberg, because he has so much money that he doesn't care about who he's donating money to him, he gets to come across as this maverick, this truth teller who could speak out about gun control or climate change, or even religious freedom when it comes to like the people who are protesting the Islamic Center being built downtown. Now the fact is, everything I just said, he's a total hypocrite on, because if you look at the policies he's doing in New York, they all contradict it. But the point is that the perception is this guy can't be bought off, right? Because he has so much money. And there's an aspect of it that's true. I mean, recently, one of his issues is gun control. I don't agree with him on gun. I think of gun control. If I was the mayor of New York City, I could impact gun control a lot by having my police department keep their guns in their holster, right? So I think his approach to but the point is that if you are for gun control, and we know that there's lots of good reasons why people are, Michael Bloomberg just came out and said his foundation, he's going to put pressure on people to stop giving campaign contributions to Democrats who oppose gun control, right? And all these Democrats are going crazy, and they're like, but then Republicans are going to get elected. And this is what Michael Bloomberg said in response. He said, if Democrats want to keep control of the Senate, what I would suggest is that they have all their members vote for things that the public wants. And if they don't do that, the voters should elect different senators who will listen to them. That's what democracy is all about. Yo, he's right. If I was for gun control, I'd be like, yes, and I'm not even really for it, and I'm still like, yeah, that's, you know, I mean, he's totally right. So Bloomberg has, he's exploited this irony of our political system, which is that billionaires like him corrupt our democracy so much that only billionaires like him get to appear to be uncorruptible. Mm-hmm. You know, like that's like that, it's crazy. He's bought integrity. And you know, one of the most infuriating things about this is you could make a case that Michael Bloomberg is the most corrupt politician in US history. And he's a different kind of corrupt than the way you think about it. But first of all, he fought his way into having a third term, right? Mm-hmm. There was a city charter that said he couldn't. But more importantly, the dude came into office being worth $5 billion, and now he's worth $25 billion. Mm. And all that money has come from Wall Street, which is the biggest industry in the city he's the mayor of, right? So every time he opposes raising taxes on banks, that's money that those banks are then spending on his company's product. I mean, that is a conflict of interest that's beyond that. But this is the power of being a billionaire, right? This guy gets to basically, I would argue, steal money from New York for the last 12 years, while getting us to, or not us, but most people, to admire him for his honesty and his integrity. Now look, I'm not gonna go through, there's a lot of billionaires. I'm not gonna go through them. I just named like a handful. Back in 1982, there were only 13 billionaires in this country, right? Now there's 442. And there's over 1,000 around the world. So each of these people, it's sort of like there's a race of supermen, and they're mostly men, you know what I mean, who have these powers around the world. And this isn't just about hating people for how much money they have, although I'm totally all for that. But it's also about the fact that when we've gone, going from having millionaires to having billionaires, is also that money has come from us, right? It's actually one of these billionaires, Warren Buffett, who said before, he said, there's no shower of money from outer space. You know, he means that this money has come from somewhere, and it's come from us, right? It's really the result of what people tend to call neoliberalism, the policies of the last 30 years, you know, directly taking money from the majority of people by cutting services, busting unions, privatization. But another big part of it, too, has been shifting where investment goes from production into things like Wall Street, right? And that also includes shifting where our pension funds go. The thing about finance and Wall Street is that they get to write their own rules. One of the reasons why people have become fabulously, you know, wealthy and billionaires is because in finance, they just write their own, it's completely rigged. I mean, people here have heard of hedge funds, right? And most of us probably don't have much of a sense of what they do. But hedge funds are basically private investments. And the typical rules, if you're a hedge fund manager, you, not only do you take 20% of whatever, of how much the investment grows, that's kind of a nice amount, right? Agents in Hollywood would kill for that. They also, they pocket 2% of whatever you invest, period, no matter what happens. So if you're a public sector worker, your pension fund, let's say, invests $1 billion in a hedge fund, right? That hedge fund, from the very beginning, pocketed $20 million, whether your investment goes up or goes down. There's kind of an irony here, because hedge fund guys tend to be some of the main people backing charter schools, and they're all about public schools need to be held accountable, whatever. These guys are taking 2%, whether it fails or not, right from the beginning. They're the last people to lecture anybody on accountability. And to get back to what I was saying before, this massive, oh, we're out of time, by the way.
You're doing, you're like 20, you're 25 minutes.
All right, cool. This massive economic inequality means massive political inequality, right? So it's not just, they've been taking from us, we're not just getting poorer, we've been getting weaker. We've been getting less organized. We've been working longer hours. We've been having fewer unions, less security in our lives around healthcare, around childcare, around job security. All that stuff doesn't just make, that makes us politically weaker. That makes it harder for us to fight. We live in a much more repressive society every year, right? The growing police state, especially for people of color, for immigrants, again, police departments, ICE. So overall, it's a society that has both higher ceilings and lower floors. And that's a concept. I was just listening to Dave Zirin. He was on some sports talk radio thing a few weeks ago, and the person was asking him, like, how come athletes today don't seem to protest as much as they did in the 60s with Muhammad Ali and Jim Brown and people like that? Is it just because they can get all this money with endorsements and they don't want to screw it up. And Dave said, well, it's partly that, but it's, you know, you have the higher ceilings of those kind of endorsements, but you also have lower floors, meaning that so many more athletes are coming from families and neighborhoods that are struggling so much, people who are in jail, people who are, you know, from baseball players from the Dominican Republic where like the poverty rate in their town is over 50%, that not only can you gain so much more by being quiet, but if you fuck up and you lose, the floor is so much lower. I think that's a pretty helpful way to think about what inequality does to our society in general in terms of prospects for change. The floor is lower, right? We're so much more precarious. It's so much harder for people to organize, but also the ceiling is higher. There's so much more money in the hands of the rich and powerful to buy off, to create AstroTurf organizations, to buy off movements. So all this stuff then gets back to this question of, well, we do live in a democracy, right? Like, why are people not able to vote this stuff out? And so that's what I want to shift to now a little bit. It's talking about what's some of the weaknesses of our democracy. And I'm gonna go a little bit quicker, but I did write this earth-shatteringly amazing book that people should check out to get more about that. But just to talk about how limited our democracy is, let's just start with who's allowed, you know, who even gets to vote, right? We know. And it's a big topic of conversation, again, with the Voting Rights Act being stripped down, and who knows in the coming years what we're going to see across the South. But even before this Voting Rights Act, people tend to sleep on how many people aren't allowed to vote because they're not citizens, because they've been in the prison system, right? And it's not on the same scale as the disenfranchisement that African Americans faced in the past. But if you think that it's a minor thing, here's a thought. We all know, 2004, George Bush gets reelected. 2008, Barack Obama gets elected. The shift between those two elections is generally seen as this massive sea change in political opinion. And by American standards, it kind of is, right? Well, if you were to look at what happened between those two elections, out of every 100 voters, in the shift from George Bush to Barack Obama, 4 out of 100 people shifted their votes, right? So that's either people who did vote for Republicans and then voted for the Democrat, or people who didn't vote and then voted for Obama, right? That's considered like a big political shift in this country. In that same period, from 2004 to 2008, 9 out of 100 Americans weren't allowed to vote because they weren't citizens or because they were disenfranchised by the new Jim Crow, okay? So even in that massive political shift, you have more than twice as many people who were barred from voting as who made that decisive, the swing voters, right? That are supposed to be so key. That's how limited even our democracy is, even in terms of who gets to vote now, before the effect of the voting rights, repealing the Voting Rights Act takes place. There's also, the fact is, even the limited democracy, the question of who's voting, if you live in Detroit, you no longer even get to vote on half the stuff you did because your rights have been stripped. This isn't just happening in this country. People in countries like Greece and Spain are having their decisions being taken away by the European Union. So the austerity is making this even worse. But then, of course, there's the question of even the people who do get to vote, what is it that we get to vote on, right? Or do we get to vote on whether companies are going to lay people off or cut bonuses for executives? No, that's not put to a vote. Do we get to vote on whether or not the NSA is going to spy on us, like Glenn Greenwald was talking about last night? Of course not. So it's really a very limited range of things that affect our lives that we get to vote on. And finally, in this country in particular, we've got the two-party system, which basically presents the Democrats as the party of the people, but is a party that's really just as controlled by the wealthy as Republicans, right? And so this really has an effect of kind of choking the life out of independent protest movements. And so I think a very good example of that is what happened in the protests in Wisconsin 2 years ago, which began with the incredible occupation of the Capitol in Madison, when Scott Walker, tried to ram through a bunch of anti-union, budget cut legislation. And people should, now that Occupy's happened, we tend to take these massive protests for granted. When Wisconsin happened and people occupied the Capitol, they had the people's mic, they started doing all sorts of, people would just set up committees to do first aid stations and press. I mean, this was like, people were like, whoa, like, this is a new kind of protest. It's a new kind of democracy. It's mass participation. When that occupation eventually ended and most people in it decided, okay, let's take all this energy and put it into, a recall vote, we're going to get rid of Scott Walker and we're going to elect a Democrat, it's amazing how some of the same people, once they go into the electoral arena, all that democracy, all that participation, just it sucked the life right out of it. To the point that those people who were controlling their own, holding their own stuff down in the Capitol, end up having to be behind a Democratic candidate who doesn't even oppose any of the things that Scott Walker was trying to ram through. Tom Barrett, the Democrat who ran, wasn't against getting rid of collective bargaining rights, and he wasn't against the massive budget cuts that Scott Walker was doing. So it's really what happened in Wisconsin in a short period of time is an incredible sort of, not experiment, but you know what I mean? Like, it's where you could really see the difference between a participatory grassroots democracy and what, you know, formal electoral democracy looks like. And after Scott Walker won that recall, you know, partly, look, he got a ton of money from the Koch brothers, and this was one of the first elections that happened after Citizens United, and it was just like that flood of money came in. And for a lot of progressives and liberals, that became the main takeaway. Like, oh my God, this is what Citizens United has done to our democracy. And partly they were true. I mean, like, yes, that's a part of it, but it was totally skipping over the fact that there was an even bigger threat to our democracy that election showed. I mean, at the end of the day, what's a bigger threat to democracy? If the other side gets to spend all this corporate money, or if our side, if the guy on our side isn't actually on our side, if we don't even get to choose our guy, right? That's in some ways, that's an even bigger threat, right? So I think also what happened in Wisconsin, what happened in Wisconsin, it gets to the importance of another aspect of the word democracy, not just the formal system, but us, okay? There's an incredible series of books that Hal Draper wrote on Karl Marx's theory of revolution. And in the first volume, it's all about what Marx wrote about the state and democracy and all this stuff. And towards the beginning, Draper, because he's going to be quoting from Marx throughout this thing, he's like, okay, first of all, we have to understand that the word democracy had very different meanings in the 1800s in Marx's time than it does now. It didn't just mean a system where you vote every 4 years and hopefully you have freedom of speech and things like that. The word democracy back then meant all that, but it also meant the popular movements. It meant the spirit of egalitarianism. It even meant the people. So like in England, there was a movement called the Chartists that were one of the early union movements, and they called themselves the democracy, right? Like democracy meant the force of the people. And it's a use, I mean, Draper's talking about that just so you'll understand the different way the word's being used at that time. But it's a useful way, I think, still of thinking about what democracy really means. The strength of any democracy is going to be directly related to the strength and organization of the popular forces. I mean, today, the chance that if you're on a protest and you chant, this is what democracy looks like, that's getting at that same spirit. And if you look at both the occupation that happened in Wisconsin and then the defeat of the recall, it shows the potential that we have in this moment to rebuild democracy, our strength in that sense of the word, but it also shows how long we have to go, right? You know, in that occupation, very as great as it was, you know, few people there had been activists before, right? So a lot of them were gonna have faith that like, yeah, let's do a recall, we could channel all this into a recall and it could be a totally different kind of election. And even the people who were more dubious about that, they didn't have their own networks to organize to be able to try to do something else. The only organizations that really existed beyond small ones like the ISO were the unions that were there, who, you know, initially played a great role, but almost every union leadership in this country is completely tied in with the Democratic Party, right? So in Wisconsin, they wanted to stop the occupation, which was directly threatening their very existence, so that they could do a recall later in the year so that hopefully a Democrat could get elected, so that maybe next year they could overturn this thing, even though right there they were all masked to try to stop it. And it's not just about unions. I mean, most of the organizations that have been the backbone of previous struggles, right, environmental groups, feminist groups, civil rights groups, have become, you know, really incorporated into being part of the Democratic Party, right? And again, it's not just because the individual leaders of these organizations are just sellouts. It gets back to that higher ceilings and lower floors thing, right? The body of these organizations, the people, we're getting weaker, we're getting less organized. The pulls from the top, whether it's from rich donors or the Democrat, you know, the billionaires at the top, their pull is getting stronger, and so that's how our own organizations have actually been kind of swept away from us. And I think this is just as big a threat to democracy as Citizens United and lobbying and stuff like that, that we don't have our own organization. So that's how you get something like currently the immigration bill. You know, how is it that we go from Obama being reelected, and it's widely seen that one of the reasons is a rejection of the Republicans' horrible anti-immigrant stuff, and now we have a bill going through Congress that's a Republican fantasy, even if they're pretending it's not. It's all about enforcement. It's all about creating a second-class, you know, system of labor and stuff like that. Well, it's part, you know, there's a lot of lobbying involved. There's agribusinesses and construction, you know, that's lobbying for stuff. There's all sorts of military companies that are lobbying for border security. But it's also because our own organizations, our own unions, and our own immigrant groups are starting more from the point of view of, like, we need to get a win for Obama than from the point of view of, like, what's the starting point of what equal rights, you know, full citizenship immediately for immigrants would be. And it's, you know, we could go through lots of other issues where that's the same thing. I know I'm now kind of getting into just, like, complaining about, you know, our political system. And then there's been plenty of that over the years. I think the point that I want to get back to is, as I conclude, is that we now finally are in a political moment over these last couple of years where more people are not just complaining and cynical about the system, but are starting to figure out what's an alternative that you know, what could real democracy look like. So let me just finish up with a couple more thoughts about this, like I said, this sort of global moment of protest. And again, you know, people, just because there aren't, things aren't popping off in your city or, you know, in America right now, things are coming back. We're not done with this moment. So if you look at anything from Occupy to, you know, the assemblies that are happening right now in Turkey or Brazil and other countries, one of the things that's so important is that people are, we're trying to experiment with creating our new organizations that aren't, you know, subsidized by the billionaires or owned by them in some ways, right? At the same time, we also know that just one wave of protests or creating, you know, assemblies, that's not going to be enough to fundamentally change the system. I think the two tasks that we're facing right now, and I'm not trying to pretend like, oh, this is my prescription for, you know, every movement around the world, but basically there's two common tasks that are going on, which is one, that we have to start building up not just protests, but institutions on our side, our own organizations that can last from protest to protest. And I think that's sort of that building our democracy in that sense that I was saying Hal Draper was talking about. And then I think within that too, we need a left that's trying to give some sense of direction and where these things are going, right? So just a few words about each of those things. In terms of what it means to build lasting organizations, to build our democracy, right? These, you know, the assemblies that are happening, new, you know, unions, political parties, a lot of this stuff is kind of new forms, right? I know I've been an activist for like 15 years, and in the last 2 years, every week, I feel like I'm learning brand new stuff. And I think most people who are activists have that same feeling, right? Because you've got certainly the experience for us in Occupy, being part of, you know, new coalitions, new styles of organizing. In the labor movement, the experimentation with different kinds of workers' organizations, unions, you know, non-union. And there's lots of talk on the left as well about different left organizations trying to come together, forming new types of parties. Certainly what happened in Greece with Syriza, you know, was an eye-opener to people around the world. I mean, I guess one note I would say about it in this context is that it's important to see that where most of these new formations happen out of people's experience and working together, not just people proclaiming something on the internet and then it happening. But like this is all in motion, right? And it's also, we gotta be patient, right? This stuff is gonna be messy and it's gonna take time, partly because, you know, we live in this imperial country that likes to talk about people around the world they have very weak democratic institutions. You know, we're gonna need to invade them to help them, you know, rebuild that. We have really fucking weak democratic institutions, right? I mean, like, I'm talking about the left, I'm talking about the broader, you know, our movements, you know, I'm talking about our entire democracy. We do not have much experience building democratic institutions, and so it takes time, it takes failures, and it takes successes. But beyond building these institutions and the organizations, there's the question of where are we going? What direction are we trying to take it in? And that's where I feel like folks on the left have to cohere around wealth redistribution, right? The idea that you cannot have democracy without this kind of economic inequality, right? And I would just say, I think billionaires are a starting point, right? I mean, you can't have billionaires in a real democracy, right? And this goes against that conventional wisdom I talked about in the beginning, that you've got to keep economics and politics separate. I think there's a lot of people that would argue, well, if you're taking wealth from people, that's infringing on their rights, right? And I think, you know, we've got to be clear that, like, there are rights that conflict with each other, right? Before Citizens United, one of the most notorious Supreme Court rulings in this country's history was the Dred Scott decision, right? Which basically declared African Americans to be subhuman, really. But it also said, it nullified something called the Missouri Compromise, which had barred slavery in the north of the country. And it said, no, there can be slavery anywhere. And it did it in the name of liberty. It did it in the name of protecting rights. It said, if we don't allow slaveholders to bring slaves into the North, we're denying their right to their property, right? And so, and you know, from today's perspective, that's a horrific, twisted, you know, view. But we want to get to the point where the idea that any one person has the right to $1 billion to be a god over us, that they can make us do almost anything they want for, because $10,000 to them is actually 50 cents. We have to get to a point where that is seen as a twisted idea, that anybody would have a right to that amount of money, okay? And just, I mean, the last thing I want to say is that, there are gonna be people in these movements that disagree with that. And if you look at these protests spreading around the world, there's more right-wing elements in Brazil and in Turkey. In the Occupy movement, there's tons of libertarians that were attracted to it. That's okay, but that's why we need to actually cohere a left-wing that's, you know, that's arguing about wealth redistribution, right? And that's part of democracy too, is actually internal debate and fighting for your side. To just take a step back, last thing I would say is that these protests around the world, this moment for democracy, it's a big deal, right? After almost a century of Stalinist history basically enforcing this idea that capitalism is what leads to democracy and that socialism is about dictatorships, there's finally the opportunity in the coming years for us to reestablish what was the original Marxist movement, which was called social democracy, right? Which was that socialism is actually is taking democracy to a higher level that capitalism never could be at. Yeah, I guess I would just conclude by saying another world is possible once we take Michael Bloomberg's money.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.